Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. On April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold left an indelible stamp on the American psyche. Their plan was staggering: to blow up their school, surpass Oklahoma City in horror, and leave a lasting impression on the world. The bombs failed, but the unprecedented attack unleashed a new era of violence in schools, branding every future shooting another Columbine. When we think of Columbine, we think of the trench coat mafia, Cassie Bernal, mistaken Columbine martyr, and Patrick Ireland, the boy in the window, the whole world watching his gutsy escape. Now, in a gripping work of journalism, a full decade in the making, comes a story we never knew. In this revelatory book, Dave Cullen debunks the myths and produces a profile of teen killers that burrows to the core of psychopathology. He reveals two radically different killers, Eric Harris, the callously brutal mastermind, and Dylan Klebold, the quivering depressive who journaled obsessively about love and attended the Columbine prom 3 days before opening fire. Columbine unfolds seamlessly in an unforgettable tale of two honor students with a healthy circle of friends secretly stockpiling a cache of weapons in the basement. They recorded their vitriol on film while manipulating every adult who could have stopped them. Described by Cullen with a sharp investigative eye and a psychological acumen, culling from hundreds of interviews, thousands of police files, testimony from world-class psychologists brought in by the FBI, and the boys' videos and journals, he delivers the first comprehensive account of the tragic Columbine school shooting. A riveting tale of murder, redemption, police cover-up, and a town torn apart, the haunting cautionary tale for our age. Columbine, with my special guest, Dave Cullen. Welcome to the program, and thank you to agreeing to this interview, Dave Cullen.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you very much. First off, if you could tell us a little bit about why and how you became involved and why you decided to write Columbine, your book about this tragedy.
Sure. Well, it was a very slow evolutionary process. I never really set out to write a book initially. I was a journalist and writer living in Denver, and I was a freelance journalist then, and I just happened to turn on the TV just as it was getting started, as the first local news reports were coming on. And I thought it would probably be nothing severe. There were no reports of injuries, and I figured, I was kind of optimistic. I assumed that nobody was hurt, but I decided to go out there just in case. And I didn't know where it was. I'd never heard of Columbine. It was out in the far western suburbs, out near the Rockies. And so I got in my car and drove in the general direction. And as I was driving on the highway out there, I saw out the window to my south an arc of helicopters circling around like vultures, and it was a terribly ominous sign of like six or eight of them, and I couldn't believe it, and I realized, wow, that must be it. And that was the first moment where my heart sank and I realized this was much worse than I thought. I had no idea how bad, and I still didn't really think anybody had been killed, but I thought it was something bad. And I literally just drove toward the helicopters, and I drove till I hit a police barricade. And then I got out and ran on foot. And, you know, of course, it turned out to be what it was. And I wrote a story for a website, webmagazinesalon.com, that day, and then they wanted me to keep covering it, so I stayed out there and worked it every day. And then I worked on a longer piece that took nearly a month, where I reported on the evangelical Christians, and I decided to sort of immerse myself in that world. I enrolled in Bible study at Cassie Burnell's church and various things. And then after the first month, I thought I was done. I remember telling people, thank goodness, you know, I never want to cover another murder again. And, you know, it was a rough experience. And I really thought I was done. But I kept getting drawn back because I felt like we hadn't really understood it. And we didn't know why these boys had done it. So I kept coming back and coming back, and I did a long investigative piece and broke some news, and just that didn't satisfy me. Then I had to eventually get to the psychologist, and that took a couple of years because the FBI wasn't allowed to talk to people, and it took me a couple of years to get permission to talk to them, sort of hounding them. And gradually over time, I realized that there was an incredible story here. It was much bigger than people understood. And that it would make an interesting book, and that I wanted to devote, I thought, a couple of years to it. And I had no idea it would stretch out and take 10 years to do. I don't think I would have done it if I had known going in that it would take 10 years. If somebody had said that this would take 10 years to do, I would have tried something else. But
yeah, of course not.
It just worked out
now,
that way.
Yes. Can you take us back to the community where this occurred?
Sure.
For those people that don't know, Jefferson County here, we'll tell us where this is located in the U.S. and take us back and sort of describe the community for those people that don't know.
Yeah, well, it's just outside of Denver. It's, you know, in Denver, we refer to it as the Metroplex, and it's on the very edge of suburban sprawl, on the western edge. And it's about probably 40 minutes from downtown. And it's sort of an interesting area that was mostly populated in the 70s, flight from the cities. Until that time, when Columbine was actually built, in the 70s, I believe, it was built on a dirt road, surrounded by horse ranches. And so it was sort of a very Old West character, and this is when Denver really hadn't reached that far, but suddenly the people were coming. So suddenly all these subdivisions went up in rapid order and became quite a large, relatively densely populated area. I mean, densely suburban. But they never incorporated. And that's one of the things of understanding this area is there were a couple different referenda over time about incorporation, but the people didn't want to. They're sort of anti-government there, so there's no town. It's just out in the country. So there's no police department. They use the fire department from the neighboring county, and there's a school district countywide, and then there's no police force, so they just use the county sheriff's patrols, and there's a small investigative unit and so forth. So that's why those people ended up having jurisdiction, just sort of this weird sort of country, suburbanish area with no downtown. In some ways, it's a lot of like a lot of other suburbs, but I called it New Columbine and Old Columbine. There's still a lot of flavor of the people who've been here there for 100 years or more, and their families, and sort of very Western. And then it's got the suburban character with most people who didn't even come from Colorado, who, from all over the U.S., immigrants. So there's sort of a mix of different kinds of people. It's relatively affluent, I'd say upper middle class, barely upper middle to upper middle. I hope that gives you a bit of an idea. Nice school, nice, clean, very low crime, wide streets and cul-de-sacs and that sort of thing.
Right. Now, tell us a little bit about Dylan Klebold's early life growing up and where he originated from, and tell us about his parents and just generally how his life really was growing up.
Well, Dylan grew up in the area, and his parents were both they were both art majors in college. They met at Ohio State University, and they were they definitely weren't hippies. They were sort of artsy intellectual, kind of altruistic, and optimistic people. And sort of romantic. I think that really the key to understanding them is that they had two boys, and they named them both after romantic poets. Dylan was named after Dylan Thomas.
Right.
And so that gives you a sense of who they were. They were very idealistic, anti-gun. They didn't ever have guns in the house. And Tom actually eventually got a major in, I believe it was geophysics, and started in the oil business and did well there. And then they had some rental properties on the side, and that was successful enough that he started managing them full-time as his job several years before Columbine. And then his wife, Sue, is a very outgoing person, and she worked in the local community college system and worked with some special needs students. And Dylan, and they got a property. God, it's hard to describe to people who don't live there. It's out, what's called out past the Hogback, which is like a row of, you know, we call them foothills there, but they're higher than any point in the whole Appalachian range. So they're about the Hogback is maybe 500-700 feet high, and the Klebolds had a property just beyond that. So it's really kind of secluded. There's a path that you go through in what looks like mountains. There's a little path, and then behind that there's this beautiful valley. And people have probably seen Red Rocks Amphitheater on television or HBO specials or wherever. There, you know, lots of major acts do concerts and film them there because it's just extraordinarily beautiful. That's just a few miles from there. And the valley they live in looks like sort of a mini Red Rocks. And so it's sort of an idyllic place where Dylan would sometimes go out with their friends of the Browns and go out, you know, fishing and, you know, just doing sort of like Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer sort of things out in the woods. So it was sort of more of a country area at that time when he was a boy until the people started coming, well, just as he was growing up, the suburban area sort of reached out there to almost meet them.
What was his character like as a young boy, and were there any noticeable problems noticed at school, we'll say, for example, or any run-ins with the law at a young age, say before high school?
No, there were definitely no run-ins. until really the year before Columbine. He did very well, but he was extraordinarily shy. He was very bright, and he was put into a gifted program, I believe in second grade, called CHIPS. I don't forget what the acronym was for. But it was a special program for gifted kids, who was very, very bright. And but he was painfully shy with strangers. But then with people he knew, he was really warm and sort of cheerful. Dewey Brown, who was a neighbor at that time, described how you know, she would take the boys out a lot, you know, doing sort of fun boy stuff. She was sort of the tomboyish mom in the neighborhood, would take them out. And Judy said that, you know, Dylan would see her and would come run up and smile and run up and hurl himself into her lap and hug. And so he was very affectionate with people that he knew, but really, really standoffish and afraid around new people. And that really wasn't such an issue when he was small, because the gifted program was a really small selective program. So he was with the same kids year after year with, you know, occasional kids would be added to the program over time or would move into the area. But for the most part, it was like a school within a school, within a relatively small grammar school. And so it was a very small group, and he felt very comfortable there. But when he went to middle school in sixth grade, that's a much bigger school. And sort of several grammar schools fed into that middle school. And he really had trouble fitting in. So not only did the school, I think, triple in size, but then they didn't have the gifted program, so he went out into the mainstream. And so it was his circle of peers, of classmates, was many times larger. And he never really adjusted to that. His parents felt that they knew that he was going to have trouble because he was shy, but they thought that he would get over it, but he never really did. And then when he went to high school, it continued, and he remained that way all the way until the end. And, particularly with girls, he was shy and would be afraid to speak around strange girls. And so that was sort of the nagging thing that his parents worried about. And they figured that he would grow out of it, hopefully when he went to college. They were hoping, first of all, over high school, then maybe when he went to college. A lot of people sort of come into their own later on. And they didn't realize that also during high school that he was terribly depressed. Because he was quiet and morose around other people, but they weren't around him, and he was really close, especially with his father, Tom. And so they didn't realize how badly that he was hurting inside. And we know now how badly he was hurting because he kept a journal for the last 2 years of his life. And he dated the entries, so we know when they were taking place. And the very first entry, he mentions suicide. And, it's a safe bet that wasn't the first time he thought about it, because he's very open about it's clear from his writing that he's already thought about this. So no telling how much further earlier he was contemplating it. We just have no record. He was contemplating suicide for 2 years through high school, and really in the journal talking about how depressing his life was, how miserable, sometimes lashing out at God quite frequently for, giving him this horrible life. Why did you do this to me? He sort of presents himself almost as a Job figure a lot of the time in the journal, he's really, really struggling. And his parents knew that he was struggling, but they had no idea that it was that bad. And Sue Klebold, just a few years ago, wrote a really amazing piece for Oprah's O Magazine, talking about that and saying in that retrospect and in reading his journals, she can see that, but she had no idea at the time. And trying to alert other moms, really, of the danger that if you see a kid, you see some of these warning signs to get them help. So in retrospect, that makes sense. But other than that, I think to most outsiders, he looked like a typical teenage boy who's sulking a lot.
Right. Now, tell us about Eric Harris, his father Wayne and Kathy, and his wife, his mother Kathy, and if he had any siblings.
Sure.
And when did the two of them, Dylan and Eric, actually first meet?
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric is a polar opposite of Dylan. I mean, he's almost, the flip side in a lot of respects. They have some similarities. They're both very bright. And they had some of the same interests. They liked video games and they enjoyed bowling and some other activities. But as far as their personalities, they were like night and day. And I'll back up a little bit. Eric was a military brat, as they refer to themselves. His dad was an officer in the U.S. Air Force. He was in for 20 years. He eventually retired as a major, and he was a test pilot. So they moved every few years, and was it now 5 or 6 different cities, towns, they're mostly, small army towns in places like, I always mispronounce this, Osceola, Michigan, in sort of northern northeast Michigan, Plattsburgh, New York, really, you know, small Army and Air Force towns. I shouldn't say Army towns. I was in the Army, so I think of them as Army towns, but it was Air Force. And so they were moving around a lot. Eric had one older brother. Both Eric and Dylan each had one brother who was about 2 years older than them. And, you know, they did a lot of – Eric did a lot of, you know, playing Army games with his brother and some other friends when they were kids. And we know this because Eric wrote about it in some of his school papers, just sort of describing his childhood in a lot of different places and talked about that, sort of fantasizing about it being a Marine when he grew up. They met – Eric and Dylan met and Kathy, for the most part, worked inside the home. She had some part-time work, but, you know, she was moving every few years as an officer's wife. And so, you know, she'd have to be changing jobs every couple of years. And took care of the boys for the most part. You know, people in the Air Force unit. Eric's dad, Wayne, was very strict. He was, you know, a typical military man. And Eric seemed like a pretty normal kid as far as we can tell. He was fairly shy as a kid, not nearly as much as Eric, but he sort of came into his own around junior high, high school. He started coming out of his shell. And Eric and Dylan met in junior high. The Harrises, after Wayne retired from the Air Force, they relocated to outside of Denver to Jeffco. And so Eric and Dylan went to the same middle school, and that's where they met. And nobody actually remembers. There's very conflicting reports of exactly when they met, but it was probably seventh grade. And they started hanging around somewhat. They became closer in high school. And kind of a circle of a few different friends. They were really close with Zach Heckler, another kid named Zach Heckler, early on. And that was sort of the threesome, did a lot of things together in the early years in high school. And there were like four or five or six of them that tended to hang out a lot. But they had sort of a tight circle of friends. And Eric was getting more and more confident and aggressive, and he would walk right up to girls and introduce himself, chat them up. Eventually, both of the boys got jobs at Blackjack Pizza, which is a chain sort of like Domino's. You know, Eric would sometimes, they'd meet girls at the mall, and Eric would say, you know, come in at Blackjack and I'll, you know, slip you a free pizza. Sometimes the girls would, and, you know, he would sort of use that as a technique. And nothing was too out of the ordinary, or seemed too out of the ordinary, except that Eric was very charming, good with people, sort of a schmoozer, which is typical for a psychopath. And eventually he started having more and more grandiose ideas and fantasies about killing lots of people, and his fantasies really revolved around annihilating the entire planet, of killing the human race. That's what most of his fantasies that he writes about centered on. So I think with a lot of killers, readers or people in the public assume he's sort of somebody like Eric would work his way up to, like, oh, I want to kill one person. No, I'll kill 10. No, I'll kill 50 or whatever, and sort of working their way up to what they would do it in their fantasies. It was really the opposite of Eric. It was scaling down his fantasies to what he could realistically do. And he started keeping a notebook. It wasn't a journal in the classic sense of a journal. It was more of a notebook to leave a record of the mass murder that he was planning. So it was specifically about the murder plan and documenting it, rather than Eric is like a kid pouring out his thoughts and feelings about everything under the sun. Eric started his journal a year before Columbine, so that's when we have a really good record of his thinking, and he also dated his entries conveniently for us. And a year ahead of time, a year before Columbine, he started it, and he's already planning mass murder. And the first phrase of the journal is, "I hate the effing world," where he spelled it out. And he really hated everyone. And a few months after that, in one of the entries, he's talking about how he wants to destroy all of Denver and how beautiful this scene he's imagining with all of downtown Denver in flames, the skyscrapers burning to the ground, and he's done it all. And in the middle of that sort of fantasy about what he'd like to do, he starts complaining. And he says, "You know how hard bombs are?" He said, I titled one of the chapters, "Bombs Are Hard," because it's an actual quote from Eric. And he says, "You know how hard it is to produce just one bomb or to blow up one building? It takes a lot of work, and, you know, it takes all this resources, and I can't do all that." And so he realizes he's realistic. He's not delusional. He's not somebody like Joe from Virginia Tech, who's deeply mentally ill. Eric knows exactly what he's doing. He's very rational and realizes, you know, he can't gather enough explosives to blow up downtown Denver. And he finally realizes, okay, I can do one building. I can do a school. And he can't get truckloads of fertilizer like Tim McVeigh, but he can build propane bombs, like you've seen on the internet, or from the he downloaded the Anarchist Cookbook and learned how to do these. Luckily, he did them incorrectly. But he realized he would do a series of, I think there were seven big propane bombs. And that was sort of the backbone of the plan, is to blow up the school and kill most of the people in it.
Okay, just before we go into the entire plan, which also included after that, killing rescue workers as well.
Sure,
and any survivors.
There were sort of three acts,
Let's just go back to what it seems like, if not that I put too much stake in this as a real catalyst, but this did occur, and then these journals started after that. Tell us about the van break-in and Dylan and Eric being caught for their crimes, the result, and what happened after that.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me back up just slightly even before that, is that Eric had a gradual progression in his sort of criminal career, if you want to call it that, which definitely was leading toward a life of crime. Their sophomore year, they had these series of just vandalism things, which Eric sort of grandiosely referred to as the missions, actually in his website. We have documented then he would write about them, which were it was a little worse than just, you know, teepeeing or toilet papering people's yards. They would crazy glue mailboxes together and screw up their alarm systems. And and then they were throwing off firecrackers and building and putting firecrackers together for larger explosions, and so it was this sort of coordinated, nasty little series of vandalism, and that's the first recorded sort of petty crime that we have of Eric that he documents himself. So that's when he was a sophomore. You know, lots of kids do that. It wasn't anything terrible, but we do see it as an early step. So late in that, one of the things they do is they steal some signs, and not just from somebody's house, but from a business. And that's where we see his first sort of petty theft. So he's moved on to theft. Then one semester, they started stealing computer supplies from the school. So Eric and Dylan were both bright, and they were they volunteered in different activities, and they were in the computer club, and so they had access to some computer equipment, and they started stealing it. And that went down over the course of at least a semester. They got caught in one of those and had to return some of the things. Eric also claimed, there's no evidence that he actually did this, but he claimed that he was that he had a scammer. He was stealing Visa information and then using it. But there's no record of him getting any of the money. That was probably him bragging about something that he was planning and wanting to do and hadn't figured out how to do yet. But you can definitely see this progression. And then they started stealing more and more things. And just a little more than a year before the murders, in January of 1998, they were out one night on, I think it was a Friday night, and they were kind of bored, and they drove out into the country and pulled over to this little strip on the side of the road, this sort of a gravel strip, and were breaking things. And they were like, it was a place where sometimes people would pull over and drink beers, high school kids or college kids, and drink beer and leave their empty bottles out there. And so Eric and Dylan were picking up the bottles and smashing them, just for fun. As some high school brats can do sometimes. So they were doing that. They got bored with that. And they're looking around for something else. And there was this one, there was a van parked out there and just left there out sort of in the middle of nowhere, which seemed kind of odd. And they went over and looked inside, and there was all kinds of interesting looking stuff inside. Electronic gizmos, it looked like. And so they decided they wanted to break in and steal it. And they took a couple different rocks, tried smashing the windows, and they were really surprised that, car windows didn't smash as easily as you thought they would. So they were going for bigger rocks. They were new to this sort of thing until they finally found a big enough rock and smashed through the window. And then they started just pulling all the stuff out, hauling all the stuff out of there and piling it into their car. And, they were just delirious with joy of just, like, getting away with something. They didn't even know what the stuff was. In fact, in the police record of it, Dylan, they had to say what they had, admit to what they had stolen. And Dylan gave a list of things. It was sort of like a yellow thing with wires sticking out of it. And so they didn't even know what this stuff was or really care. It was more, about the thrill of stealing. So they did that, and this was at night. And they piled in their car, and then they got the heck out of there, and they drove toward Dylan's house on the other side of the hog back into the state park and pulled over in the parking lot of the state park to look at all the stuff. And they turned the little dome light on in the car to look at it. I didn't really think about the fact that the parking lot was deserted because the park closes at sunset, and so you weren't supposed to be in there. And they're going through all this stuff and didn't realize that, they're just like, with a light on, they're just like a beacon to anybody driving around in the area. And it's, it's mountainous. There's lots of high ground around. I forget now whether it was a state trooper or a county trooper, patrolling the area sees us. Light on in the state park, which is supposed to be closed. So he drives down there, pulls up. The boys are so oblivious and so excited about what they're doing and discussing and going through all their loot and seeing what it all is that they don't even notice this cop pull up behind them, get out of his car, stand there and just watch and listen. And the cop is just listening and recording what they're saying and can hear them. And they get out of the car and then they're suddenly like, oh, we better take care of this before somebody catches us. And I mean, it's sort of comical now because they were just such goofball kids about it. So they get out of the car to go put it in the trunk, and that's when the cop shines a flashlight in their head, and they're totally busted. So he takes them in, and it amounts to they're charged with three felonies for this because it was more than $1,000 worth of equipment. And, Dylan immediately confesses and said, yes, we did it, and blah, 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 tells the whole story, because they were taken to separate rooms, of course, and interrogated separately. So Dylan confesses to everything. Eric blames Dylan, which is just like him. That, it was mostly his idea, but, of course, he points the finger at Dylan immediately, just whatever, to get himself out of trouble. Their parents were called. They were arrested. They were fingerprinted, put through the whole process. Their parents had to come and bail them out. And then they were charged with three felonies, which is, serious. They could do, time in prison for this. And, of course, they're grounded. Their parents were both just furious but also aghast and, couldn't believe that you know, very kid sort of brilliant boys have been charged with felonies. So Eric's parents in particular, Wayne decided they had to get him to see a shrink. And Wayne kept a notebook of his own where you can see the stuff documented, called all sorts of different psychiatrists and psychologists, interviewing them to see who would be the best fit. So you can see how seriously he's taking this. He didn't just say, oh, send the boy to a shrink and, you know, call somebody. He took an active role. So you can see the kind of hands-on parenting that he's actually doing to get him to see somebody. And they actually put him on an antidepressant. They put him on Zoloft and for several weeks, and then that wasn't didn't seem effective, and so they switched him to Luvox. So, you know, they were very hands-on about this. But Eric was even much more furious about this, and it's really typical for a psychopath to have that kind of reaction because there's so much about power and control. Everything, they're incredible control freaks. And so if you can imagine somebody who's a control freak where you take complete control of his life, where now Eric's dad is just watching his every move, and he's grounded, he can't leave the house, they're on to him, and then they the kids applied for and were allowed into this program called Diversion, where most states have this, where the kids have to, for juveniles, if you get into trouble, if it's your first offense, and basically it's a year-long program where you have to do several things, you know, make restitution to the victim, apologize, go through anger management and lots of different classes, see a counselor every couple weeks, get to do urine tests periodically, randomly, to do drug screen and alcohol screen, so you have to, you know, abstain from doing any of that. And then if you complete it successfully, and you have to do community service. So, and then if you complete that successfully, and I believe a year, and then your record is clean for another year afterwards, then it's expunged from your record. And so they were in that program and heavily monitored, but Eric sure didn't like it. I mean, you know, Dylan wasn't thrilled with having to do all this stuff, but for him it wasn't like an emotional thing. Like with Eric, it was, how dare these people do this? And who is this judge to sentence me to this program? Who is this, you know, bleeping social worker or counselor that I have to go report to every 2 weeks? So he really snowed the counselor, because we have the records of the counselor made notes every session, every 2 weeks. And Eric is going in there and snowing. First her, then him. It was two different counselors over time. But he was just snowing them and making them think that he was just this wonderful, lovable kid. Meanwhile, he would go home after the sessions and write, you know, how much he hated them and how dare they. You know, they were inferior beings. He was the, you know, he should be in charge of the whole system. And it just infuriated him all the more. So you're right. If there was it was a very gradual progression in Eric's fantasizing and his road from sort of petty criminal to mass murderer. But if there was that one moment that ramped things up, and that was probably it, where, you know, he had so much of his control taken away from him, and that is just infuriating to a psychopath. And, you know, that's when his blood was boiling and he was ready to strike back at the world. And, you know, Columbine was, in his mind, was a terrorist act. It was a way to attack the entire world, to terrorize all of us, to scare the hell out of all of us. And on television, it was a made-for-TV event. He talks about his audience. He actually uses the word "my audience" in his journal of how we were all nationally going to respond, nationally and internationally going to respond to this thing. So it was his way of getting back at us.
Okay, now in preparation for this massacre here, they just tell us just a little bit about the plans, the complete plans of what mm-hmm. they had originally intended to do, then lead us into what they actually did that day,
okay.
And take us back to that whole event, take us to that event, please.
Yeah, well, they structured it in three phases, or three acts, like a movie, and they were big into movie making, and so they had, may have planned it that way. But there were definitely three phases to the attack. The first phase, the most important one, was the big bombs. And they had two big propane-based bombs that they were taking into the, they carried in the cafeteria, hidden in duffel bags. And these were made of those just standard propane tanks that, you know, anybody has in their backyard, the standard barbecue things that, you know, you can get at the local grocery store, and then you refill them there. So they were that size, sort of like about thigh high or knee high. So that was the, sort of the core of it. Then they rigged each one up with a can of gasoline, all sorts of different thing they use for shrapnel to try to injure more people, and then wired up with those old-fashioned alarm clocks with the bells on top as timers and detonating devices. And they really thought these were going to work. So they had one each in a big duffel bag, and the plan was to carry them into the cafeteria right at the start of a lunch period when there was 600 people pile into the cafeteria for a lunch is the most popular lunch. And there's just mass confusion. I've been in there many, many times, and it's just like a beehive, you know, or ant colony, you know, people swirling everywhere. And Eric actually knew that this was the prime moment because he had spent time, this is how cold-blooded he was, he had spent time where he'd sat down in the cafeteria during the period before and the start of a lunch and inventoried how many people were in the cafeteria before the bell rang and then after. Every 2 minutes or so, he logged, you know, it was just 50 people in here. Now there's 100, 150, 200, 300, 500, up to 600. And he had, you know, almost minute by minute when it peaked and then it dropped because so many people, Columbine's an open campus, so a lot of the kids, especially the juniors and seniors who have cars with a driver's license, leave campus and go to, you know, Wendy's or McDonald's or Subway or whatever for lunch and come back. But they use the cafeteria typically as a rendezvous point. So everybody piles into the cafeteria, they meet up with their friends, then they go out to their cars and get out of there. So it swells up to about 600 for a minute or two and then drops very quickly as a lot of the people leave. So Eric had logged all this and knew that 1117 was the maximum human density of any of the number of people anywhere in that school anytime during the day. So that's when the bombs were set to go off. So they were going to carry those in with the detonators to go off just a few minutes afterwards. There was just a short time there so nobody would discover the bombs in the interim, hopefully. And they had practices where they would set the bombs down near two pillars, which hopefully would also bring the ceiling down upon them. So they set the bombs down, they quickly exited the cafeteria and went out across the parking lot out in a V formation toward where they had parked their cars in specifically designated places that they had practiced. And from each of their cars, then they would go to their individual cars and pull out another backpack with all sorts of ammunition for their guns and also about 100 different pipe bombs. And they would gear up, they'd practice this so they could do it more quickly. So they got on their bandoliers about their body, their military web gear they strapped on. So all these explosives are strapped to their body. They had, you know, things so specific, like they had flint match strikers down their forearms so that they could strike the Molotov cocktails or the pipe bombs more quickly and set them off more quickly. And then each of them loaded up with a gun. They each had one sawed-off shotgun and then a different gun. Eric had a carbine rifle, and Dylan had a Tech-9, which is sort of like a Glock or a poor man's Uzi or Glock, a 9mm, very powerful, submachine gun, automatic, semi-automatic. So they each had two powerful weapons and then all these pipe bombs. And then they were supposed to wait just a minute or two for the bombs to go off. And then when the bombs went off, that was Act One, and then the school would blow up and be burning down, and whoever survived it, and within the cafeteria, but then people from the rest of the school would presumably flee the school. And from their vantage points, they had two of the three major exits of the school covered. And Eric was right near one of them, and Dylan was near the other. Eric was right dead on with the most important one, the main student entrance right near the cafeteria where most people would presumably come out. And that entrance, they could both hit it. They could triangulate their fire on that. And then Dylan could get one of the other exits, and then they just had to give up on the one that was on the opposite side of the school they couldn't cover. So that's when they would mow down people fleeing the building, and that's when they wrote that phase two was that when they got to have fun. And they wrote that several different places, have fun. So that's when they would, you know, kill people. And they didn't ever write down whether they planned to advance on the school or just keep their positions. That isn't completely clear what they planned to do, and I'm not sure they were sure what they would do. I think they were perhaps planning to just play it by ear and enjoy it and see what happens there. Then during that shootout, obviously they knew that the cops would descend on them and there would be an army of cops that and they expect to be killed by cops during the shootout in sort of a blaze of glory. And they talked many times in the journals and in the videotapes they made explaining themselves that they expected that to happen. They weren't sure how it would happen. Eric was talking about shooting some kid in the head in one of the videotapes, and then he said, oh, that's probably what will happen to me. A cop will probably shoot me in the head. So, you know, that's how they imagined it going down, and not knowing how long they would last, but that, you know, the cops would come and there would be some glorious shootout and that would be the end of them.
Right.
Dylan really wanted to die in the act, and he was much more suicidal, and I think the suicide was the primary, the driving motive for him. And then, you know, an angry way of killing a bunch of people on the way out was sort of gravy for him. Eric was very much different than that. He had no desire to die. He just accepted it as an inevitable result. And he painted himself as a martyr. He said, you know, I will give up my life for my cause of showing you people how pathetic and, you know, disgusting you all are. So that was the second act, is doing lots of killing with the weapons. Then the third phase, they presumably thought was going to happen after they died, and that was another series of bombs. And they each had their cars filled with more propane-based bombs and then huge jugs of gasoline. So that around noon, which is a little more than 40 minutes into the attack, there were timers set to go off to blow the cars up. And the cars were sort of doing double duty as the starting point for each of the two would be in the attack, but they would also be dispersed through the parking lot and very close to the entrances, so where presumably the first responders would set up would be performing their work. And in fact, there was a triage station right nearby, and there was all sorts of activity of people being loaded up in the ambulances. And if those things had blown up at noon, they would have killed many more survivors and the people treating them. And presumably by that time would have been captured possibly on television live too. And that's a standard IRA tactic that the Irish Republican Army used on the British Army for decades, that there would be a secondary attack so that when the British soldiers came to, you know, administer to the wounded and to, you know, deal with the situation, then they would be blown up in a second attack. So, you know, Eric did his homework and knew how that worked, and that was to be the glorious end of the whole thing. And
okay,
the school's destroyed and burning down. But oh, and I did. Oh, so do you want me to jump in and tell you what did happen, or?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, no. Tell us what did actually happen. You said he did his homework. Well, then,
yes.
You know, why didn't that happen? But tell us what actually did happen, and
yes, okay.
and their first encounter with the first person that they encountered in the school. It's a famous.
Right. Or just outside the school.
They encountered immediately. So tell us about that as well.
Yeah. So they pulled in the parking lot and pulled to their respective spots, and Brooks Brown, who had been friends with Dylan since second grade, and I believe second grade, and then on-off friends and enemies with Eric, but they had reconciled, and were friends again. He saw Eric getting out of the car. Brooke saw Eric getting out of his car just after Eric arrived to bring the bombs into the school. And Eric and Dylan had cut class that morning to prepare. They had a whole schedule for the morning of how to get the propane bombs filled and the gasoline and so forth. And we know too that they did this because they're at the 7-Eleven and the places where they went. There's surveillance video footage of them. And I'm sorry, it wasn't a 7-Eleven, but it was something like that, like a stop and go. Eric's getting out of the car, and Brooke sees him and thinks, why did he cut class? We had a test today, and storms up to sort of, lay into Eric, what are you doing? You missed a test, you idiot. And Eric just says, get out of here. I like you now. Get out of here, Brooks. And so Brooks just doesn't know what to make of that and wanders off. And Eric picks up his bag, which is the propane bomb. It's sealed so Brooks can't see that, and carries it into the school. So they set the bombs, and they're running behind time on their plan. They're cutting it really, really close. They set the bombs down, and with just a minute or two to go, they get out of there and get to their cars, and nothing happens. We don't have any record of exactly of them going out to their cars. Nobody noticed them. There's a beehive of activity, and nobody's paying attention to other kids. But what we do know is they only had about 2 minutes to gear up, to realize the bombs didn't go off, and then to make their way across the parking lot. Instead of going to the obvious place, which is where Eric was, because he gave himself the prime location by the main entrance, the main student entrance, instead they went across the parking lot over to where Dylan was, which I believe probably makes sense that Eric was wondering whether Dylan was still going to go through the plot with the plan and wanted to make sure when the bombs failed that Dylan was still on board with this. So I think he went over probably to go check on Dylan and make sure, stick close with him and make sure this really happened. They didn't seem to have any plan B for if something went wrong. So they apparently just winged it from there. What we do know is that they went up to that second other entrance, which is on the second floor, because Columbine's built on a hill. So some of the entrances are on the first floor and some are on the second. And they went up the outside stairs up to that entrance, the west entrance, and at that point, one of them, probably Eric, yelled, go, go, and they started shooting at literally anything that moved out there, anybody who'd moved. It was a beautiful day. Some kids were still leaving the school, the lunchroom. Some were coming out there for, sort of little picnics just to eat their lunch in the grass. The two boys just started firing on everyone. Mainly Eric did. Dylan only shot 5 times outside, and I forget the exact number. Eric's, I believe, it was in the 60s or 70s shots. Pretty soon he ran out of targets. But literally, kids running across the soccer field, fleeing. He shot in every direction. That went on for just a few minutes, and then. The school resource officer, who's a cop employed by the county in the school, he was actually outside on the other side of the school in his car having lunch, just watching the smoking pit on the opposite side of the school. And he got a radio call from someone in the school saying that there was gunfire or something horrible going on. So he sped around the school, and he showed up just about 4 or 5 minutes into the shooting. He opened fire on Eric and exchanged gunfire, and he was outgunned by Eric. Dylan didn't shoot at him. Dylan did nothing, but Eric shot, and they exchanged several rounds. And then Eric and Dylan retreated into the school. They were right by the door, so they retreated into the school, and this is into the second floor because they were at the top of the outside stairs by that door on the second floor. And, when you go into the building, it's very obvious when you go in those doors, the first major hallway you can turn to, which is a much bigger hallway, they turn down. And then the first big group of people you come to is the library, where there are glass windows, and you can see in all sorts of people congregate in there. There were 52 people, I think 52 kids in the library. So that was the largest gathering of people they saw, and they went right in. And that's where most of the killing took place. Actually, they shot Dave Sanders, the teacher, in the hallway before they got to the library. They'd killed two people previously outside, Dave in the hallway, and then they killed 10 more and injured quite a few more people in the library. They just sort of went around indiscriminately taunting people and shooting them, letting some go when they chose to let them go, and shooting some kids in the head without even looking, just pointing the gun under the rim of the table and firing without even knowing who they were shooting at. That went on for just about 7 minutes, and then they apparently got bored with it, or Eric probably did, as psychopaths tend to do. And then they left the library, and they didn't kill again. And, in fact, they wandered the school for about half an hour and did not shoot. There were hundreds of people in the school, and they saw all kinds of them behind doors, had a glass pane in the door, and they wandered down to the cafeteria. Kids were running to tables, ran right past them, and Eric Nolan didn't shoot at anybody. In the whole 30 minutes, the only human beings that Eric or Dylan would ever shoot at, Eric would shoot at, would be cops just almost before their suicides. So they wandered the building, they went down to the cafeteria, and they tried again to set off those bombs. That's what they really wanted to do. Eric fired his rifle at the bombs. Dylan threw a Molotov cocktail, which started a small fire, but didn't do anything. They gave up, went back up to the library, perhaps to watch their cars explode, because they went up to the library just a few minutes before the cars were supposed to erupt for Act 3, and the library was a perfect vantage point to watch that. That didn't happen. They fired out the windows, or Eric fired out the window at cops, possibly in what cops refer to as suicide by cop, hoping the cops will fire back. That didn't work. And so they retreated just a few steps back, found a spot, and each shot themselves in the head. Eric put his gun into his mouth and blew his brains out. Dylan put his to the temple, and they fired at approximately the same moment, and that was the end of them.
Now, part of the story, too, you chronicle the experiences of the survivors and the survivors at the time. Tell us about Dave Sanders. He was the teacher that you mentioned that had been shot. And when they called police, they said that the paramedics were on their way. Would they be there in about 10 minutes? And it was over 3 hours. Did that create some problem with the police force later in a scandal? And tell us a little bit more about Dave Sanders and the brave. Two of these guys were Eagle Scouts, and Aaron Hainsey and another gentleman, Kevin Starkley. Explain their role and what they tried to do for their teacher.
Okay, well, Dave Sanders was a coach of a lot of different sports. At that time, he was the girls' basketball coach and a business teacher. And he was in the teacher's lounge, which is just outside the cafeteria, and it's along the same external wall. So the teacher's lounge is very close to the outside, with windows to the outside, where Eric and Dylan were beginning firing outside. So Dave heard shots. At first it was just a commotion. Nobody knew what was going on. It was just paintball guns or fireworks or something. But pretty quickly, Dave figured out that something serious was going on outside, something very wrong. So he ran into the cafeteria to warn kids. And the first thing he did was rush out there and start yelling to get down, and told the kids to get under the tables. And you can see there's actually surveillance footage of him doing this. So he's getting the kids down. Very quickly, you can see he's thinking as he's doing this, and he realizes, no, that's a mistake, actually. I need to get them out of here. They're going to be sitting ducks if they just hide under the tables. That's not going to save them. So he changes course, and he starts saying, "No, everybody up, get out, get out, get out." He and some other custodians start helping him, sort of rounding up the kids and scrambling them. And what they decided to do was there's a big staircase on the opposite, a really wide staircase on the opposite end of the cafeteria away from the window. So the killers are outside, so that seems the safest place to herd everybody across the room to the staircase. So you can see Dave sort of running across the cafeteria and motioning with his arms to follow. Most of the kids do. There's a big wave of kids that follow. He runs up the stairs, sort of leads them up the stairs, and he stops at the top of the stairs and directs them all, and stops there and plays sort of traffic cop, directing them out to the next exit down the hallway, furthest away from where the shooting is taking place. So he stays in the building to do that. Meanwhile, you know, most people, their reaction is to get the heck out of there, to get out of the building. But his reaction is to stay and look after kids. And when the whole mass of kids then are up the staircase, everybody's out except for the few who have been afraid, and they're under the tables downstairs, so there's nobody else coming. Then he directs his attention to other kids upstairs and seeing, you know, who we can warn to get out of there. Because believe it or not, at least half the school didn't realize anything was going on. And they were further away, and they were just in class, and, you know, people were taking tests, they were doing whatever. And some, depending how close you were, some classes could hear some commotion. Some people went to the windows, and the teachers told them to sit down. So a lot of people didn't know anything was going on, so they had to be warned. So Dave starts running down the hallway, warning kids to get out of here and run that way. He goes around the corner, and as soon as he turns the corner, that's just moments after Eric and Dylan have stopped exchanging gunfire with the officer outside and enter the building and come down the hallway. So Dave turns a corner and starts walking down the hallway, the same hallway that Eric and Dylan are entering on the opposite side. So they're facing each other, going toward each other. And Eric and Dylan are entering shooting. So Dave, as soon as he gets around the corner and hears and sees gunfire, realizes that's a mistake. And he turns to hightail it and get back around that corner, almost makes it. They shoot at him. He goes down on the ground and then crawls around that corner. And a couple other teachers who are also helping round up kids and get them out of there come to his aid, put him over the shoulders, and sort of drag him down to the nearest classroom they can get to, which is Science Room 3. And in that room, there are a lot of people who have who've sort of taken refuge. I mean, there's sort of two tactics. Some people ran for it, and some people tried to take cover. So there's dozens of people in that room. They're kids and teachers who have taken refuge in that room. And it's a large room. It's sort of a double room. It's got one of those expandable walls in between. And so they've opened that wall, and people from both rooms are sort of huddled together. They get Dave down and ask Kuno's first aid. And, you know, nobody really knows what they're doing, and so they send a kid out to go see if they can find somebody who does. And so this kid's terrified. This, you know, there's smoke and gunfire out in the hallway. This kid runs across the hall to another room, asking if anybody knows first aid, and discovers there's two kids in there who say, "Yeah, we're Eagle Scouts. You know, we've been trained in all this kind of stuff." And so he says, "Come with me." So the two Eagle Scouts go back across the hallway to Science Room 3, where Dave is, and they start working on him. And they tear up their own shirts. They take their shirts off and tear them up to use them as bandages and to staunch the bleeding. And, you know, that overwhelms them pretty quickly. And so they start getting the other boys to take their shirts off and tear them up. They go through quite a few different shirts. They're pumping his chest and keeping him coherent. And, you know, other people are calling 911 you know, talking to 911 operators who are saying, "Okay, we know you're there. We're coming to get you. Just stay put. Stay where you are." And so they do, and they think, "Okay, somebody's coming to help us." But this goes on, and Dave is going in and out of consciousness or on the brink of consciousness, and The two boys, the Eagle Scouts, continue to treat him, and they, you know, figure out things to do. Like, they take his wallet out, and they look for pictures. They find pictures of his wife and his daughters, and they ask him to tell them who they are and, you know, describe them and to tell memories about them, just trying to, you know, give him a reason to fight on and, you know, say, you know, what's your wife's name and, you know, Linda's thinking about you and, you know, she's going to be so happy and just hang in there. And that kind of thing, and that goes on and on. Meanwhile, people frantically talk to the 911 operators who are not communicating very well and saying, you know, the SWAT team will be there. It'll be just a few minutes. But there's all sorts of trouble with the SWAT teams on the outside of the building. The biggest problem is the sheriff, who's sort of in way over his head, is taking command of the situation and has decided to not send the SWAT teams in to set up a defensive perimeter, which was the protocol at the time. That is how they were trained to do it. And he didn't realize really essentially that he needed to break protocol and do something different, that this was something different than the protocol had foreseen. So they didn't send any SWAT teams in for quite a long time. And then there was confusion of how the school was laid out, because Columbine had been expanded and part of it redone just a few years earlier. So the leader of the SWAT leader had been in Columbine and thought he knew it was all laid out, and he thought he knew exactly where the cafeteria and library were, where so many reports had been of the worst carnage. But unfortunately, I believe 4 years earlier, there had been an addition to the school where they had built the new cafeteria and library on the opposite side of the building and converted the area which was originally the library and cafeteria. So the SWAT leader, thinking he'd been in the school and knew where it was, didn't realize they had remodeled and was on the opposite end of the building. And so then they made their way through the building room by room, clearing each room one room at a time, very methodically, as SWAT teams are trained to do. And that took 3 hours. And by the time they got to Dave, SWAT team got there and he was still alive. But by the time they got a medic in there, he pronounced him dead.
Now, and how many other people died in the massacre, and how many were wounded in total?
Oh, well, a total of 15 people, including the killers, died. They killed 12 other students, one teacher, and then themselves. And the number of physically injured ranges from 21 to 23, depending how you want to count them. There were a couple people that had minor injuries where it's debatable whether they should be counted, but a little more than 20, depending how you count the injured. And then, of course, you know, the thing is, psychologically damaged, there were, you know, hundreds of kids. There were kids on suicide watch for a couple of years, where the post-traumatic stress disorder went way beyond that. And there were four people, the injuries that were really serious, either brain or spinal cord injuries. And at least two of those never walked again, never could take a few steps, but are wheelchair bound for life.
Right. Now, we just have a few minutes. Actually, we've gone over time, but we've got this fascinating subject that we could go on for probably another hour for sure. Certainly, the media didn't do much, didn't go very deep into the analysis of the reasons for the murders, for the massacre itself. Tell us briefly what the outcome was in terms of the media, what their idea was, what they thought of the story.
Well, the problem with the media really was sort of they did too much too soon, too much analyzing, and then didn't come back and sort of clean up the mess. In the early days, I was astounded when I went back to research, and you know, I realized in my research that the media, including me, got this story completely wrong in the early days. So I was sort of reconstructing and went back through the newspapers to see how many days or weeks it took to develop these myths. And I was astounded that, you know, it really wasn't in days, it was in hours. And almost all the major myths were in place within the first 2 days, most of them by the first day. And I was really amazed when I got the transcript of the first 4 hours of CNN coverage, and they were cutting back and forth between four local stations. So it gave you a good cross-section of what was being reported locally and nationally on the national feed. And over the first 4 hours, you could see most of the major myths take hold. And it was truly extraordinary where there's this mistaken idea that there's a profile of school shooters and that most shooters are loners, outcasts, rejects, and so forth. That turns out not to be true. The Secret Service did a really in-depth study of every single shooting like this over more than a 25-year period and determined, and the FBI did a separate study, and they both determined emphatically that there is no single profiler. And most kids are not, most shooters are not loners, they're not outcasts. Something like 30% of them are. So a sizable minority, but most aren't. Two-thirds are not. So this is just a myth. But right at Columbine happened, we already had this myth. So reporters went into it assuming they're probably outcast and start asking kids. And you can see them, you can see the progression over just the first couple hours as they start asking kids things like, so were they loners? Were they outcasts? Which is, of course, you know, leading the witness, classic leading the witness. And kids start saying, yeah. And kids who don't even know them, because this is a school with 2,000 students. So most students don't know them, and especially they're a senior. So, you know, picture your high school. Most freshmen know hardly any seniors, right, if any. Sure. Most sophomores don't even. So, you know, the majority of the kids in the school have never even met these kids and don't even know who they are. So most people who we're asking as witnesses don't even, you know, don't even know their names. So kids, and we're not bothering to ask them, you know, and TV, they're just like, you know, were the kids loners? So this kid who probably never met them and doesn't know, you know, also has heard this myth of these outcasts and says yes. And then within like the first hour or two, the questions start changing from were they loners and outcasts to we're hearing there were loners and outcasts. Is that true? And now everybody, now you're really leading the witness. So all the students, almost all of them are saying, yes, yes. And now, and kids are hearing, they're watching TV, and they're all wired up by cell phones. It was the early days of cell phones, but there were a very large number of people in that community who had them. And so word is traveling like wildfire from the TV through cell phones. So everybody's getting word of this, like, oh, yeah, we're hearing they're loners and outcasts. So now 2-3 hours into it, kids who've already heard via TV that they're outcasts, and that when they're asked by a reporter, they say, oh yeah, they were outcasts. And so it's this loop where we're running around where, you know, we're telling the kids via TV, then the kids are telling us back and corroborating it, and so we're all sort of sure of it. So by nightfall, you know, as far as the media's and the kids in the school now are concerned, they were outcasts, they were part of the same thing is going on with the trench coat mafia. And then this idea takes hold that they were targeting the jocks, because one girl comes out and they made some comment about jocks in the cafeteria or in the library. Probably all jocks stand up, but they were dissing every conceivable group, one of which was jocks. And some kid got it into their head, oh, they were targeting jocks, so started spreading that word. So that went like wildfire. So by nightfall, we in the press had assumed we were understanding these killers, why they were doing it and what was going on. and we just went with that. And there was this great need to understand why. So by the end of the week, one of the papers, USA Today was the leader in this, had determined that there had been this big feud going on the previous year between this group called the Trenchcoat Mafia and with some of the jocks, which was true. What wasn't true, what they failed to understand, is that Eric and Dylan were really never part of the Trenchcoat Mafia and that the whole thing had fizzled out and didn't really exist anymore. So this whole feud with the jocks was something that had happened but had nothing whatsoever to do with Eric and Dylan or with the murders. But we just sort of pieced these little bits together and sort of jumped to conclusions and assumed, feud with the jocks and the trench coat mafia. And these kids, we'd already mistakenly put them in the trench coat mafia. So that was the reason. So by Friday of the week, you know, it was given as a fact that these kids were outcasts who had a feud with the trench coat mafia, who were doing the whole thing as revenge for this feud. None of that had anything to do with what had happened. But we'd sort of gone from speculating to ironclad conclusions about what had caused this in the matter of 2 to 3 days. And once we had these ideas, we were just sticking with them. And there was no real evidence backing up any of this. And the cops, meanwhile, and the FBI, this huge team had been brought in, did have access to the killer's records, had nearly 1,000 pages of writings they had left behind, had their journals, had videotapes they had created, explaining themselves, and were watching these things and realized that none of this stuff being reported had anything to do with reality. And, you know, the FBI agent Dwayne Fuselier, who became a major source for the book, you know, was telling me years later that each night they would go home after, you know, the investigative team working on it during the day, and we're starting the motives and what was going on, what the killers were all about, was starting to take place. They would go home and turn on the television or pick up a newspaper, and it was like the media describing a completely different massacre. And we could just, without intending to, we take these little scraps of information and piece together this whole sort of plot and this idea of what was going on, which was completely wrong. And we just ran with it, and we convinced ourselves collectively that was the answer, and told the public, and the public believed it. It seemed plausible. And so there was this sort of rush to judgment about what had caused it. And in response to this desire to want to know, the public really wanted to know why, so we figured out some why and told it to them. It just didn't turn out to be, you know, the correct why. And Columbine was a huge story for several weeks, and then, you know, as these national stories happen, then, you know, just with a thud, then they're done, and the media goes on to something else, and really never went back and investigated and figured out and reported that, oh, we got that whole thing completely wrong. And there were reports. I mean, there were most of the major papers did run a story 6 months or a year later of the myths of saying, oh, we got all these things wrong. But by then, the public really wasn't paying attention, and we didn't really ever go back and shake the public and say, wait a minute, the whole story that you'd heard that we reported, we got it completely wrong. You know, it wasn't like leading to Today's Show or, you know, anything like that. So the public really never got wind of it. That reporters on the story knew, oh, we completely screwed that up, but the public never really got wind of that.
So it took you 10 years of research and writing to create this definitive book about the Columbine High School massacre. What do you think you learned that you wouldn't have learned if you wouldn't have spent that specifically that 10 years of research on this book? What did you learn in that 10 years that you just couldn't have learned in 2 years?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, the most important evidence in the case, which is the killer's, the killer's journals, and actually that whole 1,000 pages, nearly 1,000 pages of their writing, that wasn't released until 7.5 years afterwards. There was a court battle.
Right.
The Denver Post, to their credit, filed a Freedom of Information Act and took it all the way to the Colorado Supreme Court and won a unanimous decision, forcing those to be released. But that was over 7 years later. So in the early versions of the book, which I had, you know, done in the first couple of years, we were still years away from even getting that material released. And those journals are just shocking in what they disclose. So the police had access, the investigators had access to that, but we in the media didn't for many years. So that drastically changed the nature of the book, of understanding. And until that point, I'd gotten access to the investigators and could talk to them about it. And, you know, they could explain the killers, but I didn't have the first hand, you know, I hadn't been able to read it all myself. I'd been leaked most of Eric's journal by then, but I hadn't read Dylan's at all. And I hadn't had a chance to sit down and study them. So I really, really understood the killers much better later in the process. And the other thing is that this book is sort of the chronicle of the killers, but also the survivors. It's two stories where I go back and forth between them in time. And the survivor stories really hadn't happened yet. They hadn't been completed until, they go on indefinitely. Of course, their stories go on and on. But really, they settle down. Oddly enough, I've found for a lot of people after 5 to 8 years, a lot of the people sort of, the victims got to sort of a stable place. A lot of the people, like Val Schnur, somebody who I wrote about in the afterword that I did a year later for the paperback edition. She said at the 5-year anniversary, all these news organizations were coming back for anniversary stories. Again, it was national news for a day or two. And they were all trying to write the happy story, about how survivors got over it and it was okay now. And she said, that made her very uncomfortable. She was sort of avoiding them because she was still a complete mess 5 years afterwards. Her life was completely off track. She'd been shot several times, had almost died through it, and psychologically completely messed her up. And it was about 7 to 8 years afterwards where she got her life together. She went back to grad school, decided she wanted to be a social worker. She went back to school, figured that out. And now 12 years out, she's very happy. She's loving her job, feeling very fulfilled. She's engaged now. Life is great. But her story really wasn't complete till about 7, 8 years out. And there were quite a few people in that boat. So it really turned out 10 years was a good time because, it took me years to write all this and to edit and to shape it into a compelling story the way I wanted. So I really needed 7 or 8 years of the survivors to live their survival, to have that story. I think, 20 years out, there would be a little more to their stories, but I don't think the second 10 years will change significantly. The first 7 to 8 years, their stories changed drastically.
Now, thankfully, the book received renewed interest when it was released, and I also wanted to ask you this. This I'm very curious about was the what was coined the basement tapes, the home recorded videos. These have been withheld from the public by the police. Why is that, and what is their content, and did you get to see them or know of their contents?
The basement tapes are the tapes I referred to earlier, the videotapes that the killers made explaining themselves. And there are other tapes that have been released of their target practice at Rampart Range, various videotapes the killers made for school and just sort of documenting their lives, driving through the Wendy's drive-thru for breakfast. So we have lots of glimpses of the killers. But the specific tapes, which are called the basement tapes because they were largely made in Eric's basement because he had a room in his bedroom in the basement and a little area outside of it is where they set up these in a talk show format to discuss the killings that they were planning. And they did this over several sessions, a little more than a month before the attack. Those tapes have never been released. There was one, they showed them Time Magazine first exclusively, and Time had this big cover story several months after Columbine in December, and then the Rocky Mountain News demanded to see them. They showed them to Rocky, and then they had to show them to the rest of the press. So they had one showing of them for everyone else locally in the press one afternoon. I was not included because the guy in charge of the press was furious with me because I had leaked the first passages from Eric's journal a few months before and divulged some of the things that he was very mad at me about. So I was excluded. They said they were going to have other showings, and they kept saying that, and then they never did. And then they decided that for various reasons, that they were going to withhold the tapes from the public and they had all sorts of different reasons. But the biggest one was that they were afraid that a reason with some legitimacy, that they were afraid that the tapes might inspire other copycats, might make The killers look heroic in the eyes of some teenagers with a problem. So they wanted to withhold them. So the contents are known because that group of six or eight reporters saw them and wrote about them. And then also a police evidence person wrote up, it's about, I think it's eight pages, single space, a report really detailing, you know, each tape and what's said with huge numbers of direct quotes. I mean, that matches with what the local press who saw it saw. So we have a good record of what's on them, so we know what they contain. But as far as everyone being able to see them, no, that's been withheld. The Denver Post also was demanding release of them in that same lawsuit with the killer's writings. And I simplified that story a little bit when I told you earlier. What the Supreme Court actually decided is that all this information that was demanded by the Denver Post was a public record. And Colorado law says that any public records have to be freely disseminated to the media or to the public, except in cases, I forget the exact wording, but it's something like when local authorities feel that it's in the public interest or that there may be a danger to the public. And so so the Supreme Court, the Colorado Supreme Court, had decided that, yes, in fact, these were public records, and sent it back to the sheriff, who could then still say on the technicality, well, that it's in the public interest or it's a danger to the public. And it was assumed and widely reported that if the sheriff did rule that way, it would go back to the Supreme Court, who would likely decide, no, it isn't in the public interest, you have to release it. But that's how the courts tend to go. They answer the question before them. And so at that point, the sheriff decided, okay, I'm willing to release all the written records, the killer's journals and the other 1,000 pages, but I'm still holding back the videos on this technicality that it's in the public interest. So at that point, the Denver Post decided not to appeal it and to drop it. And so all the documents, the final documents, were released, but not the videotapes. And the way it stands, there have been a couple more sheriffs since then. That sheriff was voted out. Well, actually, we were already on a later sheriff by the time this went to the Supreme Court. But we're a couple sheriffs later, and they've still continued to say, you know, they don't want these released. But any future sheriff of Jefferson County at any time can release them. So presumably someone will be elected at some point who will say they should be released. Most of the public, almost all the families involved, the victims, want them released. And it's really odd to me that that they still haven't. But we're still waiting. You know, there's no surprises on there because we already know what's on. But I think it would be useful, especially for scholars, for you know, people who study these kinds of killers, psychiatrists, sure, to see them.
Yeah, we've got only a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you one question that I think a few people might ask in light of Michael Moore's documentary, Bowling for Columbine. Could you tell us what you thought of Michael Moore's depiction of the issues raised in your book and also just with the case itself? And just briefly tell us what you thought of Michael Moore's take on the Columbine and his documentary, Bowling for Columbine.
Yeah, well, I don't think it was a really serious take. I mean, I see what he does as more entertainment. There were some interesting things in the movie, but it wasn't really about Columbine very much, and it was more about guns and gun control. And I thought there were some interesting things in there. His idea, there were some really sort of ridiculous ideas in there too, like that there was a Martin Marietta plant. Well, they merged with a couple different countries. There was a big defense contractor plant nearby because it was Lockheed, then Lockheed Martin, nearby building, I can't even remember what it was, bombs or guidance systems or military stuff, and that you know, that impacted the local people. That's just the silliest thing I ever heard.
Sure.
You know, and I don't know. I just don't really consider it that relevant. There were a couple really good films, fictional films, about Columbine. There's one called, oh God, it's either Zero Hour or Zero Day, which is sort of a fictional depiction of killers like that, which was really, really on the mark. I thought really did a really good job. And then there was one much later, just around the time my book came out, called April Showers, which is from the point of view of survivors. And I thought told that story really well, including survivors, including the killer's friends, and how difficult it was for them, where they were seen as pariahs and sort of the community kind of turned on them. And it was actually made, the film was made by one of the survivors of Columbine, who is now a filmmaker and did a really good job. But I thought that, you know, so if you're interested from sort of like the killer's point of view or the survivor's point of view, there's one really good film for each of those.
Oh, great. Well, I want to thank you, Dave, for coming on, and very informative and fascinating subject and book that you have, Columbine, about the Columbine High School Massacre, and you go into incredible detail. We didn't get into half of what really talks about, but a lot of the survivor stories are very fascinating, and some of the journal entries are just amazing, and it really is a real example of psychopathology with the sort of descent in that year of reading what these guys were planning, and especially Eric Harris. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the program and for a great interview. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and you have a good evening.
You too.
Okay,
bye.
Good night, Dave. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them, with your host, Dan Zapaski. Good evening.